This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community. This is the World Wide Wave.
This is World Wide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show. We take you around the globe one country at a time. In the studio tonight, hello, Paul.
Hello, Matt.
G'day, Damien.
Hi.
And I am Matt. We travel the world each week on radio and bring you lots of interesting people. And normally we focus on just one country each week. But tonight's guest has been working in the HIV and health space for 30 years all over the world, from Kyrgyzstan to Fiji and Indonesia to Zimbabwe. So we just couldn't restrict ourselves to just one country tonight. Indeed, we are like kids in a candy store trying to pick a country.
So we asked ourselves, how do you bring HIV services effectively to prison populations?
Is Australia still at the forefront of the fight against HIV and AIDS?
And what are the ingredients to deliver a successful HIV program in a foreign land? To share his worldly insights, tonight we are joined in the studio by Professor Robert Powell from the Burnet Institute. Based right here in Melbourne, the Burnet Institute works to achieve better health for poor and vulnerable communities in Australia and internationally through research, education and public health.
Worldwide Wrap, LGBT news from around the world, scanning the globe for stories for the diverse gay and lesbian communities from Australia's Joy 94.9. This is the Worldwide Wrap.
Kicking off in Austria, you may have heard news that they have had a very close presidential election, which has significant impacts for the gay community. The country this week held a presidential runoff election between Norbert Hofer, leader of the far-right Freedom Party, and the independent Green candidate Alex van der Bellen. The pair were separated by just 0.2% of the vote, with 4 million votes cast. Mr. van der Bellen from the Green Independents pulled off a very narrow victory, about 20,000 votes.
I wonder if they're asking for a recount at this very moment.
Could well be. Now, the trick here is the Freedom Party has an overtly anti-gay platform that aims to exclude gay people from the right to marry, as well as rolling back current laws to do with LGBT adoptions. The winner, the Greens, have repeatedly filed same-sex marriage legislations in the Austrian Parliament, though it hasn't yet attracted enough support from the other party.
The president for Austria is largely a ceremonial role, but the contest has livened up the debate about the rejection of mainstream politics, not just in Austria, but in other nations in Europe.
Indeed, there seems to be a bit of a phase that the world's going through in sort of going to the extremes. And even more interesting, because Austria's had a bit of a pro-gay profile recently with, of course, Austrian drag artist Conchita Wurst being very prominent in the country. Even her support has not assisted in getting the equal marriage bill. The last time that went to a vote, 110 to 26 it went out by.
Now over to the United Nations, where major Western nations are protesting a move to block gay and transgender groups from attending a high-level United Nations conference on AIDS. A letter from Egypt on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has asked that 11 organizations be not allowed to attend the conference next month.
So 51 countries have signed this letter?
Well, one country on behalf of 51 countries.
Right, on behalf of, yes, representative.
Yes. But we assume that, yeah, the other 50 did agree to the letter. they've tried to ban organisations that are focused on gay, lesbian or transgender rights. So the US ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, says that the groups have been singled out purely because they've chosen to be involved with gay and transgender issues, and they have asked that the groups be allowed to attend.
Canada's ambassador has also spoken out, and the Australia's UN ambassador has written a letter of protest about the so-called request to have them excluded.
400 non-governmental organisations wanted to attend the meeting, which is being held at the UN headquarters on the June 8th and 9th, and there were objections to 39 of them, but this was actually reduced to 22. We're not sure if the 11 are in part of this 22.
And over to Singapore, where there's a new campaign urging the public to wear white to promote traditional family values by a Baptist church, which will coincide with the annual Pink Dot Rally championing the lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender community next month.
So Pink Dot is, in Singapore, it's pretty much one of the biggest visible demonstrations of LGBT rights and pride in Asia.
28,000 attended last year.
And this is like the anti-version.
This is going to apparently show up at the Pink Dot Rally and, yeah, have the anti-version. Mr. Kong, who is the senior pastor at the Faith Community Baptist Church, said, and I quote, "It is a message to LGBT activists that there is a conservative majority in Singapore who will push back and will not allow them to promote their homosexual lifestyle and liberal ideologies that openly and outrightly contradict our laws, our government's stated policies, our national core values, and the Conservatives' majority's views on public morality, marriage, and family."
The National Council of Churches in Singapore has spoken up and said that it does not condone homosexual or bisexual practices, but it also does not condemn those who are struggling with their gender and sexual identity. Let's just walk that fence.
So, yes, what you're saying is let's just sit on that fence nice and neatly. The Pink Dot Rally will be held at Hong Lim Park on June 4, so that's coming up soon, and they will be introducing a new format this year which allows local participants to hold up placards instead of the customary pink torchlights, a move organisers say is aimed at letting people have their say. Now, having just read the first part of that news article, that could come back and bite them.
Stick with the pink lights. Across to Scotland now, the Church of Scotland has taken a historic decision, sort of. They're allowing gay clergy to marry, so they're allowing their ministers to be in a same-sex relationship.
Yes. But
not
you
in their
knew it was coming.
But not in their church.
Not in their church. The church is retaining the traditional view of marriage between a man and a woman.
So did you get that? The clergy themselves can get married, but they can't get married in their church because their church doesn't support marriage equality.
Yes, it's up to individual congregations to opt out of the traditional view of marriage.
In brief, in Honolulu, they have agreed to pay $80,000 to settle a lawsuit from two gay women who allege a police officer wrongly arrested them after seeing them kissing in a grocery store.
In the Seychelles, they're opening their arms to LGBTI people by scrapping the Section 151 of the country's penal code, which stated that men that had sex with men could be jailed up to 14 years.
Over to Bolivia, where Bolivian politicians have approved a bill to allow trans people to change their name and gender on official documents. Trans people will still need to apply to the Ministry of Justice for a psychological examination prior to legally changing their identity.
And here at home in Victoria, you heard it on the Informer just before us, the Victorian government has become the first government in the world to formally apologise to those convicted of homosexual acts. And that's a wrap.
That's your Worldwide Wrap. Keep up with LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like us on Facebook, Worldwide Wave, or visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hi, this is Jessica Stern from Outright Action International, and we work to bring visibility to the struggles of and discrimination facing lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex people all across the globe on Worldwide Wave.
Messages coming in, and we love them. Thank you very much. Brad on the iPhone app. LOL, the irony, white being traditionally seen as virgins, given traditional mothers and therefore families are not virgins. Oh, hadn't thought about it that way. Thank you there, Brad. And Florence, we've actually posted a photo of this on our Facebook page. Florence, very proud to see the rainbow flag above our parliament today. A permanent fixture is great for our livable city. Thanks for that, Florence. Tonight in the studio, we are very privileged to have Professor Robert Power from the Burnett Institute to tell us about all the things that you're doing around the world. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We might kick off. Kick off in Myanmar, right, first of all. Sure. Tell us a bit about... I know Burnett's been working in Myanmar for quite a while, but tell us about the current project that you're working on.
Okay, well, as you said in your intro, the Burnett Institute is quite a special place because it's a medical research institute, but it's also an international non-governmental organisation. And what that means is in countries like Myanmar, although we can do lots of great research, we can also implement programs. So the work that we've been involved in quite recently is setting up harm reduction programs, particularly focusing on HIV, hepatitis C, and injecting drug users, but using 30 years of really good evidence from around the world and working with local partners, working with the Myanmar government, working with the communities to set up programs for, there's marginalized groups that are stigmatized, same as anywhere you work. I mean, as you said, I've been doing this for 30 years. The same issues come up everywhere. You know, we're working with individuals who are involved in criminal activities, who are stigmatized and marginalized, yet we're able, because of the status of our institute, to establish these programs and give services to some of these people who, are very much on the fringe of society.
Paint us a bit of a picture about the environment you work in with Myanmar. Myanmar's, a very poor country.
Yes. Yes. So the funding is external. So the funding comes from international donors, the Australian government. Some of that's, of course, matched by local funds and by funds through government departments in Myanmar. And the aim, of course, of any of this sort of work is that eventually the funding's will be taken over by the government. And that's a big challenge for all of us. Anyone working in this field and anyone listening will know, the biggest problem with development and public health and development in international settings is there comes that
sustainability.
Sustainability and that kind of sense that the donors are always going to be there, and they're not, and they're increasingly less likely to be so. So what we're doing in Myanmar, we're establishing these programs, and we're getting a lot of peer support. So there's a lot of the drug users using the programs are setting up their own self-support groups. They're actually getting involved in some microfinance programs, like developing, providing lunches in the programs, and just really
it's
trying
simple
to
stuff, isn't it?
Simple stuff. But then at the same time, we're using all the best practice around, condom provision, needle and syringe programs, linking in with drug substitution programs. So what we're trying to do in Myanmar, as we will do anywhere, is use the best evidence in that field and then tailor it to that local situation. So when we're talking about, as we are going around the world in different countries, my view has always been, in the time I've been working in this field is, you've got to look at that local context. Papua New Guinea is very different from Myanmar, politically, topographically, in terms of culturally as well. I was in not so long ago working in Indonesia with the warrior community, the transgender sex workers up in the north of Bali, where there's an acceptance of people who are transgender, but still you'll get stigmatization in those communities. So, there's some common factors. We've got to look at discrimination. We've got to look at the legal framework as well in some countries. And again, without globe-trotting too quickly, but I was working in the post-Soviet Union and we were trying to implement harm reduction programs, delivering needles and syringes, but there was, I'll quote it, Article 47 of the Soviet Duma, the Russian Duma, would say that anyone found in possession of a needle and syringe could be arrested as potential drug users, drug dealers. So it's a very multi-layered issue. It's a fine line, and we have to work on all those levels. So again, in Myanmar, which is a military junta for many years, only recently had its first elections, and we worked throughout that whole time. And another important aspect of a good development program, you don't get involved in politics. It might be contentious, but you've got to be very careful how you align yourself. We're very much able to have public health programs in very controversial, contentious political environments. Zimbabwe, for example, Robert Mugabe for many years.
I was going to ask, what was the general level of understanding of HIV in, say, Myanmar?
You'll get a really good question, and the part of that has to be health promotion and good information delivery, and you'll have people who are totally literate who will have, you know, you'll have all the same strange myths that we've heard for 30 years. You know, the longer you do this, it's like anything, isn't it? You see the same stories coming around and
the
around
same
again.
Thing keeps repeating.
Yes, it does. Yes, and you know, and there's fear and there's myth and there's, you know, there's this, the those issues have to be a part and parcel of what we do, and a big part of what we do is information. Health promotion, you know, allaying and dispelling those myths that do tend to repeat themselves, you know, yeah. Toilet seats, mosquitoes, anything you can think of.
You mentioned the politics, and Aung San Suu Kyi has, and her party has been swept to power. She's a world advocate for HIV and AIDS. Is that making your job easier now?
Well, she actually came to the Burnet Institute, and she visited our programs when she was still in opposition. I would say that we are prepared, and I have to say this because it's the truth, that we will work with whatever we've got in terms of allegiances. So if it's a difficult, we won't say just because it's a difficult environment, we won't work there. But yes, it does make it a lot easier if you've got a political party that are supportive. And that can change very quickly. I mean, many of the countries that we work in have volatile political systems, and we are in for the long haul. So, you know, 17 years in Indonesia, 20-odd years in Myanmar. We've been up in Tibet for over a decade. All very, very difficult environments.
Talking about that, how do you actually keep the politics out of what you're doing?
By putting the focus on the public health and putting the focus on examining what we're doing. Of course, we won't be hampered by the politics as far as possible, but we'll focus on our goal, which is actually to deliver services to the marginalised populations and do the best we can within that context. And we're not afraid to actually confront the legislation and point out the need for that. Bruce Parnell was on your show some time ago. He's been very involved in that policy level, particularly in the Pacific and Asian region. So that's something we do engage in. But you have to be very clear that ultimately we're working for the marginalised populations.
You're listening to Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9, where tonight we're speaking with Professor Robert Power from the Burnet Institute.
This is Dede Utomo from Kaya Nusantara in Surabaya, Indonesia, speaking on Worldwide Way.
A message has come in. Good evening, gentlemen. What significant message does today's apology have for our human rights status for Victoria? Is symbolic gestures enough? I think it's a bit more than symbolic, because people who have been aggrieved of this, who have been charged previously, can have it expunged. I think that's a bit more than symbolism for mine.
It expunged before the apology. So the apology hasn't added to that.
Right. Well, I still think it's a good thing. We are tonight joined in the studio by Professor Robert Power from the Burnet Institute, who has been just all over the world. So we sort of have just picked all these countries you've been to, and we thought we'd ask you lots of questions. So let's Zimbabwe now. We've been talking Myanmar. Let's go somewhere slightly or very different. Zimbabwe. What were you doing there?
I was there for on and off for about 7 years, and the focus of that work was it was adolescent reproductive health, but mainly in very impoverished rural parts of Zimbabwe. So, I mean, we were talking earlier on about stigma and discrimination, and the problem there was there was a huge amount of HIV in Zimbabwe. At the time, there were 25% of the adult population was infected, and there were a huge number of AIDS orphans, young kids who were fending for themselves, and a lot of issues around not money for sex, but some of these kids were actually just selling themselves for food to keep their siblings alive. And
a trading type of...
Yeah, and there was a whole trade in Zim snacks. I mean, girls would literally be selling their bodies for a packet of potato crisps, and when you talk to them about it, and this is something that's a real challenge for HIV in these kind of contexts. If you're talking to these young girls or whoever they might be about HIV... Well, let's say, you know, I might die of HIV in 10, 15 years, but if I don't provide for my family, and this often will be, you know, a young teenage girl looking after several siblings, then we're going to starve.
So that's a really interesting angle, because they're between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
It's not like they're not aware of the issues they're facing. They know that, you know, what the repercussions of
That's right.
HIV are, but they're kind of like, well, I don't have a choice. Yeah.
And they were very vulnerable. I mean, the kids that we were working with then, they was in rural Zimbabwe in three particular provinces, and we were working with the schools, we were working with the churches, we were working with the local communities to try and develop HIV responses. So that would be, there was a fabulous program in that we got from, I think it was Kenya or Tanzania, I can't remember, called Auntie Stella, which was a really nice kind of African-focused school program to educate kids around reproductive health, but also HIV and other infections. But the problem was that many of these kids were in schools where they had very little access to other resources and were absent for much of the time.
So was there any way that you could actually... Were there other programs that could get them out of what the situation they were in, as well as just dealing with the HIV?
Yeah, unfortunately, at that time, and we were talking about, you know, the political context, it was the height of Mugabe's power, and there's a kind of quasi-democracy there now. And out in the rural areas, there was, you know, economic chaos. I mean, literally, you know, I've still got in my wallet at home, I've got $50 million Zimbabwe notes, if anyone's interested. I've got a pack of them. And you would actually carry around, like in, you know, Germany in the 1930s, a truck to get a loaf of bread. I'm exaggerating, but not far off. So there was massive economic crisis. There was no... So one of the biggest problems, and you've pointed out an issue there, that for the kids, once they finished school, there was virtually no opportunities for them at all, except for the girls would end up peddling sex and the boys would get involved with pimping the girls, because I'm painting a stereotypical picture, but this was not uncommon, or else hanging out at the bottle store and getting involved in drugs and drinking. Because bizarrely, what Robert Mugabe did in those days, he created what he called growth points, which were effectively where a tarmac road met a high road, and he put in there what was supposed to be a growth point, and what you'd really have would be might be a fax machine with no plug and a bottle store, and what you'd have is all the truckers were coming along the highway, and that would be where the girls would hang out, the boys would hang out. Then you'd have, you know,
a significant problem with HIV transmission.
Yeah, and going back for decades, you know, truckers were a great conduit on highways to carry the HIV virus from one community to another. So there was a huge problem there, things haven't radically changed, but there has been some engagement with the government now to actually have a coherent response. And one other thing I might say that was a very positive, we set up youth-friendly clinics. Literally, if a young person in one of these towns had an STI or HIV positive, the nurse would grab them by the shoulder, take them down the high street to their parents and tell everybody. So, you know, it wasn't a hard change to move from that to something a little bit more confidential and private.
Robert Mugabe made many, many very outrageous statements against gay people.
Yes.
How does that impact the ability to, you know, fight things like HIV, especially in men who have sex with men populations?
Yeah. It's very dangerous. I mean, it's a very, very, very difficult environment for anyone who doesn't comply with either the laws or the culture. So it's a very dangerous place for people to be who have views or are acting outside of the stereotype of a Zimbabwean.
We've spoken to other aid helpers, and that one of the issues they've had is actually people coming to their clinics because of the stigma.
Yes.
Did you have any ways of getting around that, especially in Zimbabwe?
Coming to the clinics because of the stigma. Well, I think that's just very common. People do, but you've then got to, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier on about, you know, Myanmar. You've got to create an environment that is conducive, that is people feel comfortable in, and that's why we often, and have done for decades, try to engage peers as workers. So in Zimbabwe, in Myanmar particularly, we have a lot of those workers who do work in our outreach programs. I could talk about Malaysia similarly, Australia, every country now, we try to have peers who are actually delivering the service, and so people feel at least comfortable. The Warrior program up in northern Bali is actually run by warriors, you know, the transsexual.
You've talked about HIV transmission through prostitution and through the trucking industry there. HIV transmission in terms of drug use, because you've had some experience with heroin coming in through Afghanistan into Central Asia. Tell us about that issue.
Yes, well, since the breakdown of the Soviet Union, which was 92,
somebody will message in for us.
Yeah, someone will tell us. I think, anyway, since the breakdown of the Soviet Union, there was a huge influx of heroin into many of those countries, particularly those bordering on Afghanistan. Partly the returning soldiers were part of that trade, but actually the borders broke down, so they were much more porous, and heroin came in. So for some years I was involved in a program in Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, and if you don't know your geography, they're kind of right on the far reaches of the former Soviet Union, but very close to, they border Afghanistan and those other countries where heroin is produced. So there was a very burgeoning HIV injecting drug use issue there, and a big part of our programming was to address that issue. And then starting from scratch, all the things that you said earlier on about stigma. I mean, we literally had people who said that, very cold country, but they wouldn't hold on to the handles on the trams because they believed that you could transmit HIV by holding the leather straps on the trams. So, you know, that's again what we find commonly when we start out these programs in areas where it's new to everybody.
We've got more with our guest, Professor Robert Powell from the Burnet Institute. You're on Joy 94.9.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hi, I am Tim.
And I'm Ben.
From Hallam, Melbourne.
And you are listening to the World Wide Wave
on Joy 94.9.
You're on World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time, and we are indeed popping about the globe tonight with our guest, Professor Robert Power from the Burnet Institute. Robert, you have covered so many places and had so many different experiences. Is there a secret ingredient for the delivery of HIV prevention programs in countries? Is there a golden rule?
Is there a golden rule? Well, let me take you back, because I think, you know, we can certainly learn from 30 years. When I started off 30 years ago, there are two programs that just came to my mind. The first was on Hampstead Heath in London. It's called Gay Men Fighting AIDS, and it's way back in, say, 1986, that would have been. And what that was, it was the... For any of your listeners know Hampstead Heath. Hampstead Heath is renowned as a
Gay beat,
exactly.
Or one of the biggest. Cottage.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's a big cottage. It's a beautiful heathland. But there's some particular areas that have been used, you know, and people come from all over. And in those early days, we worked with a group called Gay Men Fighting AIDS. And what they did, they were very creative. And they wanted to get condoms out. And they thought, well, what we'll do, because men are there all through the night, they actually put up glow boxes in the trees. Which for fluorescent glow boxes, all beautiful, different, beautiful photos like lime greens and yellows.
So it looked good.
Looked good. Filled them up with condoms, and then the men, they were there. So it's like, you know, getting the reason I use that as an example is it's about getting the service out to where the people are. So if it's Hampstead Heath with gay men having sex, that's where you go. If it's, you know, a railway line in Malaysia where all the heroin was being sold and used, we put up outreach programs along the railway line. So I think part of the answer, and then I said there were two examples. The other one was the very early days of needle and syringe programs that I was involved in the UK at exactly the same time as here in Australia, other colleagues were putting in needle and syringe programs into the community. And we actually had guys going out with backpacks into the community to give out needle and syringes. So when you say, is there a, you know, it's community engagement is huge. It's hugely important that at all the levels that you engage the community, whether that's, you know, in Richmond or whether it's in Kokopo in Papua New Guinea, you engage the community. You need to get good standard services. So, you know, the Burnet, as I said at the beginning, is a medical research institute which, you know, will examine the best evidence. So we look at the best international evidence over the decades across cultures and communities, and then you will tailor that for the local environment. And then you've got to get the balance between the public health agenda and law enforcement, because as we've talked already, many of the communities that we're talking about here will be breaching the law in some ways, whether that's around, you know, sexual proclivity or around illegal activities like drug use and sex work. So you've got to bring on law enforcement, and that's a lesson we learned very early on, and educate law enforcement, and if necessary, work with the judiciary to change the law. So there's that element to it. And then it's about coverage. So maybe that's the third element to this is, you know, it's one thing to have the service in place, but you've got to actually cover your population. You know, for any infectious disease, you know, if you're going to actually have an impact on it over time, you've got to be able to cover that population. So the best way to do that is to understand the population. So use epidemiology, use kind of network analysis to understand the links between the different communities, and then find ways in which you can use those as a conduit to get your service out. And, you know, sorry, you were about to ask a question.
You were a teacher before you got into this line of work. What
That's true.
Made you change?
Well, I had a, thank you for that question, because I had a seminal moment in 1982 in Hackney in East London, where I was working as a teacher, but I was working in a centre for violent offenders, kids who'd been thrown out of schools. And I recognised that many of those kids, very deprived part of East London, it was one of the poorest parts of the UK, many of the kids were of diverse ethnic groups, mostly Afro-Caribbeans. They were involved in marginalised lifestyles. A lot of them were involved in drug use, drug dealing. And I just got interested in that area, and a job came up in 1984 to develop services, outreach services in London for young people. And I was really interested in that. 1985, the HIV issue hit the streets, and I happened to be developing these programs and was given the opportunity then. They asked us, can you start asking about high-risk behaviors, particularly amongst injecting drug users? I thought that program would last 2 years and I'd move on to something else. And 31 years later, I'm sitting here in Melbourne, very excited to be talking to you guys, but also to be part of the Burnett Institute, which is a fabulous institute doing work both in Australia but also throughout the Asia-Pacific region and beyond, as we said, Zimbabwe and Southern Africa.
Bringing you back to Australia, was seen as a leader in HIV prevention. Yeah. Where are we now? What is the kind of status of Australia?
Well, it's a good question. I'd like to think that in terms of our understanding, in terms of our influence, we are still very much at the forefront. In terms of where we are in Australia itself, we're still now behind the ball, because there are interventions that have been developed in other countries, and I can, you know, some of the interventions around HIV in prisons, some of the work around injecting drug use, providing safe spaces for them to inject. And actually, some of these, Iran, for example, is a country that's ahead of Australia in terms of its thinking in responding to injecting drug use. But we've got a great knowledge base, we've got a great history, we just probably need a little bit more imagination and ability.
A bit more push,
yeah, a political push, of course, as well. We need, you know, you do need the politicians behind these interventions, but we're still having a great influence internationally, and I'm very proud to be here and proud to be an Australian citizen, as I am now Irish and Australian.
Our guest has been Professor Robert Power from the Burnett Institute. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yang Fa from Singapore. You are listening to World Wide Wave. Lots of love to everyone at Joy 94.9.
And a big thank you to our guest tonight, Professor Robert Power from the Burnett Institute. You can find out more about their good work at burnett.edu.au.
We would like to thank everyone who's been in touch with us through Facebook. There's Mandy, Olivia, Tom, Vernie, and a hell of a lot more. That's through W3Joy on Facebook.
We had Florence and Brad on the SMS. Another one's just come in. Interesting, in countries like Greece, where funding was cut from health services, there was an increase in AIDS-related diseases for the first time in that region. Thanks for that insight there.
We're going out with a bit of Taylor Swift. This is a place in the world. She's looking for a place in the world.
And we'll catch you next week in our world on Joy 94.9.
Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Connecting, representing, celebrating. Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.